Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's Financial District. I'm Mark Stoner, your quarterly chair. We also welcome the listeners on radio, joining us today for America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. Barbara Boxer became a United States Senator in January 1993. On November 3, 1998, she was elected to a second six-year term by the largest re-election margin for any California senator since 1980. A strong California economy continues to be a top priority for Senator Boxer. She has worked to promote American products abroad and protect rights for America's high-tech and entertainment industries. As a member of the Budget Committee, she cast the tough votes that have led to six straight years of deficit reduction. Education is of prime importance to Senator Boxer. She supports specific goals to ensure that every child can read at age 8, use a computer at age 12, and attend college at age 18. Throughout her career, Senator Boxer has fought for a cleaner environment, introducing legislation to restore our nation's wetlands and remove the threat of offshore oil drilling along California's coast. She authored the Children's Environmental Protection Act, which would set environmental standards at levels that protect children, and as a step toward the goal, she successfully amended the Safe Drinking Water Act to protect children, pregnant women, and seniors. She was the Senate author of legislation that helped to preserve the Presidio of San Francisco as part of the national park system. A strong advocate of medical research, she is a leader in the drive to double funding for the National Institutes of Health. One of the first in Congress to recognize HMO abuses, she authored a Patient's Bill of Rights in 1997. The Senate's leading advocate of a woman's right to choose, Senator Boxer authored the Freedom of Choice Act and helped to lead the floor fight for passage of the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. She has authored the Family Planning and Choice Protection Act of 1999, which would protect women's reproductive health and strengthen family planning to reduce the incidence of abortion. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senator Barbara Boxer.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. Well, thank you. Well, I'm very touched by that wonderful response, and to Mark, thank you for that kind introduction. Every time I listen to some of the fights that I've been involved in, I start getting tired thinking, oh, my God, I remember that one. I wanted to take a moment before I begin my prepared remarks to recognize someone who is here with you today who happens to be one of my best friends in politics and someone that I rely on for so many issues. We talked about the fact that I was the Senate author to save the Presidio. That is a fact. This woman is the one who really put the drive behind that victory to save the Presidio. She also, when the House is taken back by the Democrats, which is a little bit of an aberration the last 4 years, this particular woman is the leading candidate for Majority Whip, which is one of three top positions in the House, very important position, and you in San Francisco deserve a lot of credit for giving her all the support that you have. And I wanted to recognize my friend Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman from San Francisco. We are lucky to have Nancy in the Congress. I also wanted to recognize my chief of staff, Sam Chapman, who I'm so proud of and who has worked so hard to run a really wonderful and fine Senate office. We have several other staffers. I won't introduce them, but I am so blessed to have so many dedicated people who stay with me a long time and give stability to what I'm trying to do. When I realized that the Commonwealth Club has hosted so many great scientists and astronauts and business leaders and nine presidents and other great heroes of mine, such as Martin Luther King, I am indeed honored that this is my second time to address the Commonwealth Club. And it is a very exciting time for me to address you, because here we are only 18 days away from the year 2000. So it is natural that we want to look at where we are headed into this new century. Now, had I been asked to give this speech, say, when I first got elected to the Senate in 1992, what do you see for the next century? It would have been very difficult for me to wax eloquent on the future challenges, because if you go back in your mind to 1993, when I got sworn in with Senator Feinstein, we made history that time. Our state was in deep economic trouble, and our country was in deep economic trouble. But standing before you just 7 years later, I can say that we are in a much stronger and better position to look at the future optimistically because of the successful policies that have prevailed in the waning years of the 20th century. Having said that, let me be clear. It wasn't easy to get these policies to prevail, and I'll get into that. So I can say to you, as I look ahead, I'm optimistic. And had I been standing here giving this speech in 93, it would have been very difficult to say that. We had to make some painful choices. We had some unbelievable challenges. We had to move from a military-based economy to a civilian-based economy. We had to move from a manufacturing-based economy to an information-based economy that counted on intellectual property. We had to solve the horrible budget deficit and a national debt that was growing exponentially. We had to turn around high unemployment and high real interest rates. And we had an out-of-control crime rate. Now, instead of taking you through all the policies, because we're here to talk about the future, I'm not going to take you through all the policies we embraced to get out of the nightmare we were in, but I want to just talk to you very briefly about two votes, just two of the many. First, the budget vote in 1993 that Congresswoman Pelosi and I remember so well, which put into place, after a horrific battle, a federal budget that started us down the path toward economic health. We had not one vote to spare in the United States Senate, not one. As a matter of fact, the Vice President had to cast the crucial vote to break that tie. And many people lost their congressional seats over that vote because it took a while for those benefits to take hold. And the other vote was the 1994 crime bill, which put 100,000 police on the beat and, with the help of Senator Feinstein, banned assault weapons. Now, let me give you an idea of where we are after passage of just these two bills. Violent crime has dropped by more than 25% and now is at the lowest level since the Department of Justice began tracking the statistic in 1973. Since 1993, 20 million new jobs have been created, more than under any other administration, and 92% of those jobs are in the private sector. The unemployment rate is now the lowest since January of 1970. Since 1993, the national unemployment rate has declined from 7.3% to 4.1%, the largest decline of any administration since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And California's rate has dropped even more, from 9.3% to 4.8%. People are working, they're building, they're inventing, and of course there's much more work to do, but I think it's important to look at the progress we've made. So now let's look at what I consider to be the four major challenges of the new century. Now, mind you, there are many more, but we don't have all day. So I've got it down to four major challenges. And these are the ones I have selected to talk with you about. One, narrowing the economic divide. Two, safeguarding our personal freedoms. Three, protecting our environment. And four, ensuring America's leadership in the world. Now, these are not easy challenges. Each one of them could take, a seminar in and of itself. But when we think back to history, when have America's great challenges been easy? Like when our founders faced the tremendous challenge of setting up a whole new nation with new rules to guide us. And I find that when we look at any challenge, it helps us to turn to the document that has guided us through good times and bad, through war and peace, through assassinations, and through deep internal divisions for over 200 years. So let me read to you the preamble of the Constitution. Because as we look at these challenges, we should always relate them back to that guide. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, as we meet these challenges, we must remember that preamble, and in everything we do, remember that our goal is always to form a more perfect union. Now, I think when our founders wrote those words, they didn't say form a perfect union. They said form a more perfect union, because they knew this was a changing thing. So it seems to me we're always working, and our successors will always work to form a more perfect union, even though maybe we do what we think makes it perfect. They're going to find ways to make it even more perfect. Now, our union is not more perfect when opportunities are denied to those on the lowest rungs of the economic ladder. So our first challenge is to preferably end, the economic divide. And how can we do it? First, I want to make sure you know that we have one. So I have a few facts. Income gaps between those with the highest incomes and other Americans have widened sharply since 1977 and are now the widest in decades. As a result, 2.7 million Americans with the highest incomes will have as much after-tax income this year as the 100 million Americans with the lowest incomes. Let me repeat that. 2.7 million Americans with the highest incomes will have as much after-tax income this year as the 100 million Americans with the lowest incomes. Low-wage jobs have put a new face on poverty in California and across the nation. In other words, people are working and they're poor. They're laboring hard. They're giving back. And America's prospering, but they're not, and that's wrong. So here's my plan to address this problem. First, and obviously, we have to raise the minimum wage so that every American gets a fair wage for an honest day's work. About 1.4 million California workers earn the minimum wage in the state, which is now $5.75 an hour, less than $12,000 a year. Now, the purchasing power of this wage is about $2 per hour lower than the purchasing power of the minimum wage in 1968. So we're going backwards. Now, here's about San Francisco. A recent study by the National Low Income Housing Coalition shows that given the high cost of a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco, a minimum wage worker would have to work, listen to this, 138 hours a week to make ends meet. This is impossible. So if we want to maintain our nation's prosperity, we need to raise the minimum wage, and we have to try to end poverty. Second, keep the earned income tax credit strong. And without going into the details of the earned income tax credit, it is really a way to help those who are working and who are stuck in those low-paid jobs because they basically get a refund. It's interesting that my Republican friends in the Congress keep trying to cut or restrict the EITC since it really was established under Republican presidents, and Ronald Reagan called it the best anti-poverty program ever devised. So we have to stand firm, raise the minimum wage, and fight for the EITC. Third, we must make health insurance a universal right. People cannot participate in the American economic dream if they're sick, if they can't get health care. There are many, many ways to go about it. Let me just give you a couple of my ideas that are pretty simple and straightforward. First, we have to make sure every child has health insurance, period, end of quote. Every child born has to have health insurance. Many ways to make it happen. By the way, it isn't expensive because most children are quite healthy, so we can do that. We should strengthen Medicare and Medicaid for the poorest and the elderly and allow those who fall in the cracks to buy into both those programs. And we should open up the federal employees' health care benefit program and allow people to buy into that, a minimum package. We can do this. We also need a patient's bill of rights. I won't go into that in detail. But you could have everybody having insurance, but if they call to get health care and nobody's home at the other end, it isn't going to help. So we need to make sure that patients have rights and that doctors can do their work without being told what to do by people with green eye shades on, because it's about health, it's not about bureaucracy. Now this year, the Senate passed a terrible bill on a patient's bill of rights. It is a patient's bill of wrongs. The House passed a good bill, and something happened on the way to the president's desk. And what happened was nothing. And we don't have that bill on the president's desk, and we will not vote for a sham bill. So we have more work to do when we get back. So we're talking about this economic divide. And let me tell you a story, my own story. I was born into, I would call, a lower middle-class family. My father was the only one of nine children to get a college degree, and he went at night. And he went to law school at night. My mother had to go to work at age 16 and never graduated from high school. And she was so smart. And when they became parents, they just said, our kids are going to go to college. And it wasn't even a question. It was going to happen. And they were not people of wealth. So I went to college. And I got a free college education. So I'm a product of the public schools from kindergarten through college. I remember my father, when he saw that each semester we had to pay a certain amount of money to this university, State University of New York. And the year it went up from $9 to $14, he said, oh my goodness, it's getting expensive. And then it went up to $24 a semester. And oh boy, we all shook our heads. What's happening? So I would not be here today if I didn't have a loving family and if I didn't have a free public education. And if it's the last thing that I will do, as long as I'm standing up and have a voice and now have a vote, an important vote, it is to ensure that every child gets that opportunity. Because if there's anything that distinguishes us from other nations, even our greatest allies, it's the public education system. And you will hear our Republican friends stand up and say how much they're for education, and they just came out here and they visited Silicon Valley. They have voted against every single initiative to help public education, including smaller classroom sizes, including school construction. I urge you to go visit some of these schools. How these teachers can function is beyond me. The ceiling tiles, like these tiles up here, are falling down. The musty odor in some of these rooms, you can't even describe. In one room, I just started to cough, and I'm not kind of a hyperallergenic type of person. But I started to choke in one school in Sacramento that I was visiting because it was so musty in there. So they vote against all these things, and then they say vouchers are the answer. Well, we can't even afford to fix our public schools, let alone worry about private schools. This is ridiculous. And the truth of the matter is, you cannot say you're for ending this economic divide. You cannot say you're for children. As my friend Nancy Pelosi often says, there are three issues that matter to her: children, children, and children. You can't say that you're for children if you're not for making sure we have the best public schools that we can have. All children deserve what I was able to get. After-school programs. How could this even be a question? If you look at crime, juvenile crime, when does it happen? After school, 3 p.m. till about 7. And then when the parents come home, it goes down. It's the best anti-crime program. It's the best mentoring program. You get the kids one-on-one. If they have that, their grades go up 75%. It's a proven fact. And yet, This president had to hold this out until the very end because we could not get that after-school bill through the Senate. It's my bill, and I was kept losing by 2 votes and 1 vote and 3 votes. The president said, I'm making it an issue in the final analysis, and he held out for those smaller class sizes and for after-school. And we are doing much better, but we still have 1 million kids on waiting lists for after-school. Early education. Now that I'm a grandma, I can talk about how little kids are geniuses. You look at these little kids, and you know, I have this policy, every child should use a computer by 12. I got to revise that, Sam. My little guy, 2.5 years old, was up there. He had his thumb in one hand, and his other hand was on the mouse, and the little blankie was hanging down. I'll never forget. And I said, this is a whole brave new world. We cannot deny kids this opportunity to learn in this fashion. So we need to make sure, even if parents don't have the $6,000 a year and the $7,000 a year, it costs to get minimal quality child care where your kids are stimulated, we should start kindergarten a little earlier. We're starting to do it here in California. Delaine Easton is very strong on this. Started a year earlier. 90% of our brain capacity is formed by age 3. Age 3. So if we don't stimulate that brain, we're wasting a tremendous opportunity here. So we need to make sure we support our children and support public schools, and I've given you just some of the things that we can do. So I'll move on to another challenge, because, you know, that one could have taken me the entire speech. I think it's crucial that we safeguard our personal freedoms in this information age. I'll tell you a quick story. I wrote a bill a long time ago called the Driver Privacy Protection Act. I wrote it in 1994. As a matter of fact, it became part of that crime bill. What did it say? Very simply, if you're driving down the street and some mentally imbalanced person decides, you know what? I want to follow this person. I want to find out where this person lives. I want to harass this person. I want to stalk this person. You shouldn't be able to call up the DMV and say, license number, A, B, C, D, E, tell me who that person is, tell me their address, and get all this information. Guess what? You could. So we passed this bill. Some actress named Rebecca Schaefer was brutally murdered in front of her home as a result of this. So we passed the bill. Some of the states didn't like it. Why? They were selling this personal data and making money for their states. So they sued, and guess what? It went to the Supreme Court, and I had the honor and privilege of sitting in the Supreme Court while that case was argued. And the states were very open. Nobody should tell us what to do. We want to sell this information, we should be able to sell it. And the Supreme Court will decide. Keep an eye on that case, because to me, it's a case of the right to privacy in this digital age. And it's very important that we be protected. How else can we defend our right to privacy? Fighting for a woman's right to choose, never giving up. This isn't a question for Jesse Helms to determine, or Henry Hyde to determine, or Orrin Hatch to determine, or Barbara Boxer or Nancy Pelosi. It's a personal, private matter that each person will decide inside themselves, with their family, with their physician, with their God. It is our right to choose. It is our decision. And I'll tell you, I have never seen an attack as I have seen since I got to Congress against a woman's right to choose. They are chipping away all over the place. And even on Roe v. Wade, we forced a vote on Roe v. Wade. That is the most basic right of a woman to choose in the early stages of a pregnancy without interference. And later on, we say, fine, the state can put restrictions on it. But in the early stages, a woman should have a right. You know how many votes we got for Roe? 51. So Roe versus Wade in the Senate is hanging by a thread, and I would suggest in the House it's even worse than that. And that's why we need to think about it in this election of the year 2000. We have to put an end to hate crimes. People cannot function in society if they're afraid because of the color of their skin or their sexual orientation or their ethnicity. They are going to be subjected to hate crimes. I had the chance to meet Matthew Shepard's parents. They came to the Congress and met with the Democratic senators. I believe they met with the Republican senators as well. All they are asking is that they be included in the hate crimes. And we see every day why this should be done. So we need to work. Again, that initiative was blocked by the majority in the Congress. And what about guns? I want to give you a statistic that you may not know. If you remember nothing else from this talk, which you probably won't, I want you to remember this. Every year, more than 35,000 Americans die by gunshots. And I want to put this into perspective. In the 11 years of the Vietnam War, we lost 58,000 Americans. That war brought this country to its knees. It's the reason I got into politics. It's the reason probably many of you got more involved. So we see that in 11 years of Vietnam, 58,000 Americans were killed, and every year, 35,000. So over 11 years, 400,000 Americans have died by gunshots, compared to 58,000 in Vietnam. Just remember that. We have a war in our streets. And yet people are beginning, unfortunately, to say, yeah, it's the way it is. We can never say that. We have to fight very hard. And there are many specific things I could talk to you about, but I'll just give you one example. Of course, Senator Feinstein has been doing a great job on this. I have a very simple bill. It says if you are intoxicated and walk into a gun shop, the dealer cannot sell you a gun. Pretty simple. We already have a law at the federal level that says if the gun dealer believes you're high on drugs, he cannot sell you a gun. All we're saying is add intoxicated. When I took it to the floor of the Senate, the NRA was in an uproar, and they tried to defeat it. But even they realized they couldn't, so they said, well, we'll just have a voice vote. We attached it to the Commerce Appropriations Bill. So it passed by an unanimous voice vote, no objection. Guess what happened? It's gone from the Commerce Bill, the only thing that was dropped. Now, you figure out who's running the United States Senate and the United States House. We need a change there. The extremists are in charge. If you can't pass, that is the simplest thing. What about the child safety lock on a gun? That's stuck in the juvenile justice bill that hasn't made its way to the president's desk. So if we're going to meet the challenge of protecting our personal freedoms, we need to enact sensible gun laws. Our environment, the third challenge. We need a permanent funding source for our environment. And I'm proud that Congressman George Miller and I introduced Resources 2000. We would take those offshore revenues. We would make sure that we can continue to buy and protect these precious lands. We need to make sure that those offshore oil leases that are out there, that are old leases, are never developed. After all, when those were leased out to the oil companies so many years ago, we didn't have this ethic about the environment then that we have now. So if we don't pay attention to our environment, and we're going to have 50 million people here in California by the year 2020, we won't be able to breathe. And so we need to get on top of that now before it is too late. In this introduction, you heard about the Children's Environmental Protection Act. Do you know that all of our environmental laws are set to protect grown-ups who weigh 154 pounds, men? That's the way. So if you are a man who's at least 154 pounds and you leave here today, you should feel good. You're okay. You're protected. Clean air, clean water, all of that. We're trying to say, that's good, but what about the more vulnerable people? Like little people, old people, little people, children. What about that? So we want to have our environmental laws protect the most vulnerable among us, and then we'll all be protected. We're beginning to make progress. Again, it is hard. MTBE, get it out of our gasoline. It is a danger. It is a carcinogen, suspected carcinogen. And Governor Davis is doing the right thing. It ought to be done at the federal level. Get rid of MTBE. We don't need it anymore to clean up the air. There are other things that we, other oxygenates out there that we could use. So if we preserve our natural heritage, protect children from pollutants, ban MTBE, clean up our polluted waters, our oceans, keep them pristine, we're going to be in good shape. And the last challenge, and then we're going to get some good questions, I think, that I want to talk about, has to do with America's leadership in the world, and I'll go through this quickly. We have to lead on global warming. With this Congress, we are not. They say it's a theory. We know it's a fact. So we have to do better on that. We have to lead on banning nuclear weapons testing and stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. With this Congress, we are not. I was sick at heart when we voted down the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the dream of presidents going way back. Remember when John Kennedy, some of you may remember this, stood out and looked at the snow falling down and the rain and said, we've got to get rid of this, these nuclear materials that are in the air from testing outside. Now we can just ban underground testing and complete the job. We have to lead on protecting the rights of women and children. With this Congress, we are not. 191 countries have ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, known as the Magna Carta for Children. Only two nations have failed to ratify. You know who they are? Somalia, which hasn't had a functioning government for most of the time since the treaty was signed, and the United States, whose Congress hasn't had a coherent foreign policy since the Republicans took over. So that's where we are. It's embarrassing. It's terrible. We have to change it. We have to change it. 165 countries, including all our major allies, have endorsed the convention to eliminate all forms of discrimination against women, CEDAW. All this treaty does is establish accepted principles and measures to achieve equal rights for women throughout the world. Only a few nations have not ratified. You want to hear who they are? North Korea, Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, and the United States of America. I'm embarrassed about it. Chairman Helms refused to schedule a hearing, and I give a lot of credit to our colleague, Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who organized some of the women in the House to march over and say to Senator Helms, what are you afraid of? We have to do better. We have to lead the worldwide fight against tuberculosis and AIDS. We passed an Africa Free Trade Bill, not one slim dime to fight AIDS. I had a little measure to help us, and it was bipartisan with Senator Gordon Smith, to help us in the fight against TB. I couldn't even get that through. Now, the last point I'll make is about free trade in Seattle, because I'm sure it's on your minds. Free trade brings rewards and problems. Unquestionably, free trade and the global economy it has encouraged have brought tremendous opportunities to our state and to our nation. And I could go into the details, but many new jobs have been created through export-related activities. And I believe if you look at the facts, you'll find out that's one of the reasons why we are in such a booming economy. In the wake of the WTO meeting in Seattle, I want to reaffirm that we do need an objective body to decide trade disputes, but we have to make a better world body here, one that is open, one that understands the importance of a clean environment and decent working standards and wages. And so I don't think Seattle was a death knell for trade, but I think hopefully it will be a death knell for secrecy, and it will be a death knell for not considering labor and environmental standards. So those are the challenges. I want to give you a quote from William Safire, a committed free trader who wrote, quote, I believe the U.S. should be a light unto nations by virtue of our example of enlightened free enterprise. That means not lowering our health and labor standards to let investors everywhere make a buck, but apply those standards to others who want to make a buck with us. I thought that was interesting. We've had presidents who have said the same thing in other ways, FDR and George Washington, who said, it will be worthy of a free, enlightened, and great nation to give to mankind a magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence. So those are the four challenges that we have to meet. And I would just say this, if we're going to do it, there's one more, and that is participation in our democracy. Today's election day in San Francisco. I only hope that people turn out, that we can do better than the god-awful result we had in 1994. In 1998, we had a 36.1% voter turnout, the lowest level since 1942 in our country. So I'm looking to San Francisco today, and I hope, because we did have some excitement in some of those races, that people will not say things like, this doesn't matter. There's no difference between the candidates. Those are the biggest cop-outs. We have to vote. Look, there will be no perfect candidate until each one of us runs, right? We have to understand that that's the fact, because no one could be better than we are. And no one could understand our point better than we could. But not everyone is willing to do what Congresswoman Pelosi and I have done, which is to put our neck out there. And it is important that voters understand that candidates are not alike. Well, if we can let our children know it's important. You know, we have a Take a Child to Work Day, Take a Daughter to Work Day, which was started as a wonderful thing, to show kids that they can do it. We ought to take our kids with us when we vote. I remember doing that with my parents. And it was such a treat, and they would explain to me what they would do. It was such a treat for my parents to be able to have this vote and to share the feeling that they had about it with us kids. Maybe we ought to do that. So if you want to start a new little happening, let me know. And we'll work on this together, and it could be born out of today's talk to the Commonwealth Club. So in closing, I believe the United States of America is the greatest country on the face of the earth. I believe we can meet these major challenges in the new century. And I face the future with optimism because of our success in facing the last set of challenges that we faced. We are in a strong position to act. And we need the help of both political parties and all voters. We need reason, not extremism, in Congress and in the presidency. We need long-term discipline, not short-term politics, to guide our economic decisions. And we need investments in our people and our country, not wasteful spending. And the election of November 2000 will be crucial in determining whether America keeps what was right with the 20th century while facing with candor and courage many of the challenges that I've outlined here today. And my faith lies with the people of the United States. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for allowing me to come up here today and share these important thoughts with you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So nice. Thank you for that warm response. And now we'll get to your tough questions.
Thank you, Senator Barbara Boxer, for your enlightening comments here today. Now, Tony Remby, Chair of the Executive Committee of the Commonwealth Club, will handle our question and answer session.
We're both short, so we're just pleased to have a platform to stand on.
No, it's the platform is tall. Okay. That's the problem. No.
All right. Thank you, Mark Stoner, our quarterly chair. We have quite a few questions today, and they're all over the board, so we'll get started. How difficult has it been to have a legislative agenda with a Republican Congress and a Democratic administration?
Well, it's been brutally difficult. And what has happened as a result of this is that the divide is so great right now. When I got into the Senate, I could tell you I could look to about 15 or 20 of my colleagues to reach across the aisle and get a hand back and work together. I can honestly tell you today, sometimes there's maybe one or two, and maybe the best of times there's four or five. And this is very, very difficult. We only have 45 Democrats. We have 55 Republicans in the United States Senate. The way we have gotten these policies through that I have talked to you about, the ones that have seen led to a reduction in the crime rate and have seen our economy bounce back, these important things were done because this president used his bully pulpit to take these issues to the American people and waited until the very end. And what I can tell you is it's not a good way, the way we've had to run this country the last several years. We've had to wait and hold all of these priorities close in because we couldn't get bipartisan support. And at the very end, when both sides were threatening to close down the government, we finally got some of these important things done. It is not a good way to run a country. And I can only hope that in this election of 2000, people will want to see a more functional and functioning government and will elect people who are not extremists. That's how I feel. We're in desperate shape to have people who are willing to work across party lines.
Numerous elected officials and commentators argue that campaign finance reform must be enacted in order for the challenges you describe to be addressed. What does the influence of big money and how does it affect your pursuit of your priorities, and how does the continuous need to raise money affect your work?
This is a very important question. And actually, in the last part of my speech, I did have a number of issues, but time was getting away from me. And one of them was, and the most important one, in order to get greater participation, we must change this campaign finance system. People are turned off with the system. They feel unimportant, left out, not part of the process, because they see that the big lobbyists, the big moneyed special interests, so often get their way. I will tell you that my fight to make sure that the oil companies pay their fair share of royalties when they drill on federal lands was the most incredible fight I've ever had to wage. I was very fortunate to get about 47 or 48 votes in the Senate to say that the oil companies have to pay their fair share. Why is this important? It's the moral thing, but also those monies in California go right into the classroom. And at the national level, they go into the purchase of important and threatened lands. We had the oil companies against us. It was very obvious. The people leading the fight against us came from Texas. And the money that went into some of those coffers, I can't even tell you, they're in the millions of dollars. Russ Feingold took an active interest in this and said this is a classic example of why we need campaign finance reform. We won that fight, not in the Senate, but because President Clinton held it out for that final bit of leverage he had at the very end of the session. So, how does it impact me? I got to tell you, from a state like California, and you could ask Senator Feinstein this because she's going to have another tough race. They're all hard. She's way up in the polls. It's still going to be a tough race. We have to raise $20 million to get our message out. If I had started the minute I got elected, for 6 years, it would be $10,000 a day for 6 years, 7 days a week. And I can truly tell you that I don't even want to think about it. And I can also tell you, even putting in the kind of hours that we put in because it's sort of our life, you are stealing time away from your work. And it is horrible. And yet, although people say it's important, they really don't make the connection so much to legislation. And I would hope that those of you here who care about this issue will make this a litmus test of the year 2000 races across the board. Look at those House members across the country and in California who fought us on campaign finance reform. Look at those Senate candidates who are now up, who refuse to support even the most modest reforms and help their opposition, because it's the only way we're going to change it. And we will have a better government when we change it. It's stealing time from colleagues, and it has a pernicious effect in terms of the way people view their government. They don't have faith in it. They don't have trust. And I understand why. If I took a check from somebody and then voted in their favor, Even though I didn't even know when I took the check they even cared about it, somebody could rightly say, I wonder if Barbara did that for the right reasons. You can only pray people know you well enough. The fact is, it has the appearance of a conflict of interest, even when it isn't. We must change it.
An area of health concern, especially during this season, is the quality of air on national and international flights, particularly in tourist class. As we all know, has anyone studied the increase in health costs and serious illness attributable to this problem? And will it take a major outbreak of some epidemic to do something about it?
As someone who travels a lot, I can tell you I share this concern. And I believe, and I don't want, I'm saying that I'm 90% sure of this, and maybe, Sam, you can tell me if I'm right, or Nancy, if you want. I think Senator Feinstein either has a bill on this or is working on a bill that would require more fresh air be pumped into the system. As I talked to her about this and told her I wanted to help her with this. So if no one is aware of it here today, I will double check on that. And I can say this is a very important issue. We obviously are picking up all kinds of conditions, diseases, and the like from this situation. And it's something we can do something about. And I think, yes, the airlines will probably fight us, but the last I checked, there were more people flying than people who own the airline, so hopefully we can make some progress on this.
Who, in your opinion, would be the best Reform Party candidate to assure a Democratic victory in next year's presidential election?
Any of them.
Your description of the challenges facing America and the solutions you propose sound more in line with the views of Bill Bradley than Vice President Gore. Yet you've endorsed Gore in the race for Democratic nomination. How do you explain this paradox?
I would say that both candidates for the Democratic nomination would share the basic challenges that I laid out. Now, they may go about them in different ways. But you have to know this. I am really proud of both our candidates. I have endorsed Al Gore. I have worked closely with him. I think that when I talk to you about the crime bill, when I talk to you about the budget, this economy, I give him credit for a lot of this turnaround because he is very involved in policymaking. But I have to tell you, Bill Bradley is my friend too. And I think both of them would agree that making sure we get rid of this economic divide, that we invest in our children, that we do something about health care, that all of these issues, campaign finance reform, I would have to say the clean environment, that they both share that platform. And I think either of them would make just great candidates. And every time I watch the Republican candidates debate, I feel more and more proud of our two candidates because I honestly think they have the depth and the vision. I don't see it in the other party at this particular point. Having said that, you can discount my prejudice, but that's how I feel, truly.
Some people think there is an inconsistency in your position on the alleged improper conduct of Clarence Thomas and that of Bill Clinton. As a supporter of women's issues, what do you see as the differences?
I've said very clearly at the time that Bill Clinton was wrong in what he did. And I said very clearly at the time that Clarence Thomas's conduct should be looked at. The whole purpose of the march across to the Senate that I'll never forget with House colleagues was to just basically say, you've got to look into this, because if you well remember back then, they weren't even going to air these charges as if they were not important. So I honestly don't see an inconsistency. Would I have voted for Clarence Thomas to go on the Supreme Court had I been in the Senate? N-O. Because I don't believe his philosophy is good for the country. He is anti-choice. He is, in my opinion, looking at the Constitution in a way that I do not agree with. But I think I've been very clear in terms of Bill Clinton's conduct at the time and spoke out in a very straightforward way about it. By the way, I didn't think it was impeachable.
Do you support Senator Bradley's health care proposal?
I have my own health care proposal that I have laid out to you. I think it's very straightforward, which is every child should be insured. We should open up the federal employee health care benefit system. We should strengthen Medicare and Medicaid. I have that proposal. Senator Bradley has his proposal. Al Gore has his proposal. Believe me, they will all move us forward.
By legislation, the federal Head Start programs for the disadvantaged are subjected to on-site quality monitoring every 2 or 3 years. Many of the state's block grant programs, such as California's school breakfast program, are so poorly administered that substantial benefits fail to reach the intended participants. Has legislation injecting some accountability into the block grant system been proposed, and do you think it's needed?
I don't think that we need new legislation to hold these programs accountable, because accountability is built in. And I had not heard about a problem with the breakfast program and the school lunch that it is going to kids who don't deserve to get a hot meal. I have visited on site of many school breakfast and school lunch programs. I am very moved by what I see there. Kids able to function because they've got the nutrition that they need. Now, with some child getting in on the program who shouldn't get in because their parents are earning more, I think it's worthy of a look. And I think that those kids ought to pay on a sliding scale if they can afford to. But I don't think you need new legislation. But what I would ask you, if you have a specific case in point where you think that there's some problem, can you let me know? Because I think we have the ability to act on it without legislation.
What do you think of Hillary Clinton's chances for a victory in New York? And are you going to campaign for her?
I would be honored to campaign for Mrs. Clinton, just as she came and campaigned for me. I think Hillary Clinton is going to be elected to the Senate from New York. And I believe this because of one basic reason. I think her philosophy, her issues, are in tune with the vast majority of the people from the state of New York. Having said that, will this be easy? No. Will this be brutal? Yes. Will it be rough and tumble? Absolutely. But the bottom line, I think what happens is they'll have Rudy Giuliani and his personality, they'll have Hillary Clinton with her personality, and they'll finally get in the voting booth and say, it's not about her, it's not about him, it's about me. And I want someone there who's going to fight for my quality of life and my kids' education and my health care and a better life for my kids and grandkids. And in my opinion, there will be no contest. I think Hillary Clinton will win, and I think she'll make a great addition to the United States Senate. And if she asks me, I'll be right out there and I'll be helping her.
A patient's Bill of Rights will increase health care costs. Are Americans willing to pay more of their income to improve health care?
Well, it's an easy question, because we have the studies that show that the increase in premium is so minimal that, if I remember my facts, it's about $2 a month of an increase on a premium. And I think, yes, that Americans are very willing to shoulder an extra $2 a month if they know that they will see the specialist when they need the specialist, that a woman can say to the OBGYN, you will be my first-line doctor here. I don't have to go through a maze of other people. I can get the prescription drugs I need when I need them. And I can get an appointment when I need one, rather than waiting around for months. So I think the cost is absolutely minimal. That has been the biggest big lie, I think, in quotes, that has been put out by the HMOs, that this will drive premiums up. We are only asking for the basic rights. And by the way, there are several HMOs who've already done this because they're good. And they're saying, well, sure, we want to have we want to adopt this list, and they haven't had to raise their premiums. So I think we're going to be just fine, and let's get on with it, because there's too many people I have met who have suffered mightily because of HMOs having no heart, no compassion, no feeling. And I could give you just one quick example of a 34-year-old constituent of mine from Southern California who was suffering from symptoms that even to the layperson would say danger, because they were the classic signs of cancer, internal bleeding and all the rest, and called the physician. You don't have to come in. It's your diet. Change your diet and call me in 30 days. The woman got sicker and sicker, called him back. I can't even get out of bed. Well, you haven't given this diet a chance. Well, by the time she got the test, the colon cancer was so advanced it was too late, and now a little boy of 6 years old doesn't have a mother. And that's just one example of hundreds that Nancy and I could talk to you about that we know because we've met the families. And so do I think it's worth $2 a month to get decent health care? You bet.
The use of the filibuster has increased dramatically in recent years, blocking the passage of much legislation favored by a majority of senators. What do you think of this trend?
The new kind of filibuster that we have is not the old filibuster. The old filibuster was really hard to do. You had to get on your feet. You had to stand on your feet. You had to show that nothing would get you off your feet. If you had to go to the bathroom, you were out of luck, or someone was out of luck. And it really was something that was used sparingly. What has happened now in the new filibuster is that it is easier to do. And as a result, it is used too frequently. It is used too often. And one example is campaign finance reform. We had the votes, a majority of the senators, to have campaign finance reform, but we couldn't get to the 60 votes. So the way we're doing the filibuster these days, we're not forcing people to really stand on their feet and show they mean it. We're making it easy. So what I want to say to you, and maybe you didn't understand any of this, is that in the new filibuster, it has meant the death knells for some very important legislation, and we haven't made people pay a price for doing it. And my view is, yes, there are reasons for a filibuster, because it protects the minority opinion. But make people stand on their feet, stand all night, make them come out, miss a night's sleep, if it's that important to them, and the country will see. But we didn't do that in campaign finance reform. We just let them block it by saying, okay, we'll agree, we'll have a vote. If you don't get 60 votes, if we don't get 60 votes to go forward, then we'll just forget about campaign finance reform. We've got to be tougher and make people go to the mat, and maybe the American people will then tune in. I launched my own filibuster on this Or Royalty issue, and they knew I would stand on my feet all through the night, all through the day. I had 10 people who were going to stand with me, the people who were fighting for the consumers, and they knew it, and we finally were able to get what we wanted, which was an up or down vote on it. So I think you've got to go back to those days. Make people who really feel strongly about an issue pay the price of a real filibuster and not allow them to get away easy with just having what we call a vote on cloture and then moving off the topic.
You know, unfortunately, we only have time for one more question. So a lot of questions on schools and arts in the school, a lot of questions on the environment, some of which you've covered. But the last question I'm reading today is, I know your major work is national, but in light of your excellent societal views, would you be willing to comment on today's local election runoff?
Well, I don't know it's appropriate to talk about who I have already endorsed, because I think it isn't on election day, one should not do so. But I'll give you a clue. He's the incumbent. Let me just say this. My most important wish is that people from every community exercise this incredible franchise that we have been given in this incredible country. And I feel if we do that, whoever wins will have some sort of a mandate to do the things that he has laid out, whoever the eventual winner may be. I think when you look around the world, people are literally dying while they're waiting online to vote because it's risky in some countries to exercise the franchise. When you think back to Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, who literally, in many ways, gave of themselves to the ultimate degree to fight for the right of women to vote, something we take for granted. When we think of all of this and we see these low turnouts, it's got to be discouraging. So let me say this. Whoever will be elected mayor today, I will work with, as I have done in the past, and I will work with Nancy and with Senator Feinstein to ensure that all the local needs are met. When you said I stress national issues, let me tell you that I have a tremendous amount of my time spent on the very local issues that you need attended to, issues like transportation and parks and recreation and environment and so on and so forth, and education that have tremendous significance here in the local area. So the election today, I hope, will be a sign that that people are alive, that they're up, that they're listening, that they care, and let's move forward from there. And let me close by saying that this election in 2000 is hugely, hugely important. Whoever your candidate is for president in either party, I should say in any of the parties, whoever your candidate is, go help him, I wish I could say, or her, but I can't. Help him. Get involved in these congressional races, in the Senate race here, and in races across the country. Now that we have access to the internet, you have a chance to follow these elections very, very closely. I hope you will do it. And I want to say the opportunity here in 2000 for San Franciscans to have a great person in the leadership of the House of Representatives, I want you to think about what that means for San Francisco, and in my view, for the state, for the country, and for the world. But don't miss this. Don't miss this point. A lot of people don't understand the importance of it. So thank you for giving me your ear, your ears, and I've enjoyed this. The questions were terrific, and I hope to see you again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Boxer, for being with us today. The meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is hereby adjourned.